We are talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
All right. And mentioned last week the passing of Ari Cohn, the founder of the Post-Prison Education Program, and just wanted to give people a heads up that the public celebration of his life will be taking place next Saturday, July 9th, at 2 p.m. at Zillow Commons, which is the fourth floor of the Melinda and Bill Gates Center for Computer and Science Engineering at the University of Washington. So we'll give you a heads up on next week's show, but by the time you hear it, it'll be too late.
Yeah. But we'll be on our way there.
Yeah. Yeah. So, all right. Starting.
A beloved KODX colleague.
Yes. And rabble rouser.
Yes.
Rabble rouser.
Which is almost the same thing.
Similar. There's a big in the Venn diagrams. There's a big overlap.
Yes, there is.
Yes.
All right. So starting out with local and this week's police related news.
Yeah. The Seattle Times reported on Wednesday that the Office of Police Accountability is investigating Sergeant Pamela St. John, who, if you remember, wrote the memo about staffing shortages in the Seattle Police Department's sexual assault unit. The complaint the OPA is investigating has to do with leaking the memo to the press and making Seattle Police Department management, including Interim Chief Diaz, look bad. Okay. So now a lot of folks in Seattle might wonder why the OPA has to get involved in a management squabble in the Seattle Police Department when they have backlog cases from 2020 and 2021 that are still open, including three cases that are complaints against former Police Chief Carmen Best. And just a reminder for people, the memo that St. John wrote said that there weren't enough detectives assigned to the sexual assault unit in the Seattle Police Department and that the unit commander had stopped assigning new cases of sexual assault against adults for investigation unless a perpetrator had already been caught at the scene and arrested. So that means no collection of evidence, no interviews of witnesses, no DNA samples run, nada, nothing for new adult sexual assault cases. In the meantime, the SPD management had reassigned detectives to fully staff up the units that cover special events like Kraken games, to direct traffic and to oversee homeless encampment sweeps, but not to fully staff the sexual assault unit to investigate violent crimes, particularly violent crimes against women. So yes, you know, that's the kind of thing that can make a police department look really, really bad, right? But I have to say that blaming the whistleblower is not the answer and not an appropriate use of the OPA's resources.
And it also doesn't recommend Interim Chief Diaz, since his looking bad was probably why the complaint got expedited.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know if that should be a source of the OPA investigating. Of course, the city council is still working on a new law that would formalize how the OPA and the OIG handle complaints against the chief of police. That's probably going to be voted on in committee within the next couple weeks. I'm thinking late July, and then moved on to the full council for consideration. They've been making changes to it to try to get the bill right the first time so that those kinds of complaints don't just languish like they did under the Durkin administration. Also this week, during the inquest into the shooting of Charlena Lyles, the medical examiner testified that Lyles had been shot 7 times. And 3 rounds had struck her in the back, including the one that likely killed her.
Wait a minute. Wasn't she shot because she was lunging at police, quote unquote?
Yeah.
With a knife?
Yeah, that's the story. A second wound in the abdomen could also have contributed to her death, but she probably would have survived the other five rounds. Of course, seven shots. I mean, come on. Lyles was barely over five feet tall, and she weighed about 110 pounds. The two male officers, Jason Anderson and Stephen McNew, are claiming that she lunged at Anderson with a paring knife. Yeah, with a paring knife. So, you know, when you hear the cops say they had a knife in their hand, it's not usually a paring knife that you envision. But in this case, that's what they're saying. Now, Officer Anderson was trained in how to use a taser, but had left his own taser in his locker because the battery had died and he hadn't kept it charged up. Last week, after one session of the inquest, members of Lyle's family confronted Stephen McNew and called him a coward and a bunch of other not very nice things as he passed by them on his way out the door. McNew, who was disturbed by that, then called his superior at the Seattle Police Department, who then called a SWAT team. Okay.
Wait, what?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. The SWAT team showed up at the building where the inquest was being held a couple of days later to check out and inspect the security in the building. Okay, and that had the effect of openly intimidating Lyles's family. Now, the Office of Police Accountability says that it is looking into this incident, but the OPA has 30 days to decide whether or not they're actually going to investigate it. Although it did prompt a reprimand from the administrator of the inquest, saying this is not okay for the SPD to do this.
I expect a firm result of that investigation in 2026.
Yeah, I know. So there you go. You know, the OPA, who could be investigating something really meaningful, in this kind of intimidation and these kind of tactics, is actually focusing on going after whistleblowers inside SPD management. Okay.
Ooh, and let's not forget that the former director of the OPA, who now works,
Andrew Meyerberg,
mm-hmm. is under investigation, I believe, by OIG for some of his activities while he was director of the OPA.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And he is now the main public safety consultant to Mayor Bruce Harrell. I'll talk about him in a minute here.
Yeah, and remember that the OIG was created in the first place because the existing oversight mechanisms for SPD were so bad that they themselves needed oversight.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So. Well, and that's the whole point of it. It's supposed to be a checks and balances system. But there have been numerous complaints that the OPA is too familiar with and too happy to go along with SPD management and not really take its remit of oversight seriously. So let's say. And then there have also been complaints about the head of the OIG being the same way, not wanting, being too collegial with the OPA and not wanting to exercise stringent enough oversight of the OPA. So that's a whole another conversation, but it really does relate to all this too. Excuse me, I gotta take a sip of water here.
Yeah, I think we're all beginning to question mm-hmm. Both locally and nationally, our systems of checks and balances.
Yeah. Now, also in the police accountability news this week, a judge ordered Pierce County Sheriff Ed Troyer to pay $100,000 in bail, and the judge revoked an earlier ruling to release Troyer on personal recognizance. The judge had initially ordered that Troyer be taken into custody, but then relented when Troyer's attorney produced a bail bondsperson who said that they would provide bail immediately. Judge Jeffrey Jan found that Troyer was, quote, a substantial danger to the community, especially Mr. Altheimer, end quote, referring to the newspaper delivery man, Cedric Altheimer, who Troyer had falsely accused of threatening him last January. Altheimer,
and who has gotten no contact order against him.
Yeah, Altheimer, a young black man, was doing his normal paper route in the middle of the night when Troyer decided to get into his pickup truck and follow him around and harass him. At one point, Troyer called 911 and reported that Alzheimer had threatened him, drawing an enormous multi-agency police response to the scene. Now, when the Pierce County Sheriff says, hey, I'm in physical danger, yeah, you're going to get more than just a couple of Pierce County Sheriff's deputies responding, okay? But at the scene, Troyer admitted that he had lied to police and that Alzheimer had not actually threatened him.
And they no contact orders because more recently, Troyer has continued to
follow him around
and harass him. Yeah.
Yeah. And Alzheimer has told the judge, look, you know, he has all the power in this situation. I'm a young black man and I'm terrified that he's going to try to set me up for a situation where he can then shoot me and say I did something wrong and I won't be around to dispute it because I'll be dead. Okay.
Yeah.
That is a real,
fear. That's a pretty reasonable concern.
Yeah, it is.
Given the record.
And, Jan specifically said that he thought Troyer would, quote, seek to intimidate witnesses and otherwise seek to interfere with the administration of justice. So it appears that Troyer is not just intimidating Alzheimer here. There's some other information that the judge has that makes him think Troyer is a huge risk to the outcome of this case. Notably, the $100,000 bail amount was 10 times the amount the prosecution had requested, reflecting that the judge thought Troyer was lying in court and was abusing his power as Pierce County Sheriff. Now, Troyer is being charged with criminal gross misdemeanor charges of false reporting and making a false or misleading statement to a public servant. So to these other officers that were on the scene that night. Last month, Judge Christine Chin imposed an anti-harassment order against Troyer after Alzheimer told the judge that Troyer was still harassing him, as we just talked about. Troyer attempted to excuse those actions to Judge Jan, but Jan found Troyer to be not credible and said his testimony, quote, makes absolutely no sense.
And if you're wondering why Troyer still has a job, it's an elected office.
Yeah. And Troyer could be facing up to a year in jail time plus fines. But, you know, if he loses in court, he could lose his job. You know, there are laws saying that if you're even if you're an elected official, if you've been convicted of a crime like this, then you lose your job. His trial is scheduled for October. So in other city council news, there was a report from the mayor's office on civilian teams responding to some 911 calls. And I want to talk about that report because the mayor's office has been working with the Seattle Police Department to try to figure out which types of lower priority 911 calls here in Seattle could be handled by civilian teams instead of needing a cop with a badge and a gun. And this week, the mayor's office gave an update to the City Council Public Safety Committee on how that is progressing. So just a reminder for people, priority one calls are major crimes and life-threatening situations. Okay. Priority two calls involve a really strong threat of violence that's not in progress, or very major property damage, or, for example, the presence of a weapon that indicates violence could be imminent. These two types of calls are calls where a response by a police officer really needs to be immediate and is a real emergency. Okay. The classification for priority three calls includes things like thefts and property damage where there's no suspect in the area to be apprehended. It includes things like building alarms, car alarms, traffic accidents that don't block the flow of traffic, parking complaints, and calls that require someone to just be a presence to keep the peace, okay? But where there's not an imminent threat of violence. Priority four calls include noise complaints, nuisance calls like graffiti and minor vandalism, requests for the SPD to watch an area, and reports of found property. So, for example, if somebody abandons a vehicle and it's blocking your driveway or abandons a car in front of your house, you can call. Or if you, say, find stolen goods that need to be returned or something. Those two call levels, are ones that, are not, don't require an immediate response, and they don't necessarily, may not necessarily need, someone with a gun and a badge, but they do need eventually to have a report done for most of those types of calls. Someone needs to go collect evidence, talk to witnesses, write up a report, right? So that's the way calls are prioritized through 911. Now the presentation on the progress that the SPD and the mayor's office is making was given by three people: Senior Deputy Mayor Monisha Harrell, who is Harrell's probably his lead advisor, Mayor Bruce Harrell's lead advisor. Also at the meeting was Harrell's public safety expert Andrew Meyerberg, which we were just talking about, and Mayor's aide Dan Nolte. Now Nolte didn't really say anything at all. Meyerberg had some comments, and Monisha Harrell really gave the bulk of the presentation. And when I say Harrell, I'll be referring to Monisha Harrell. Now, she verified that the mayor's office agrees that it's a good idea to move some low priority calls to civilian responders. So it's not as if the Harrell administration is pushing back against this effort by the council to do this. Monisha Harrell agreed that yes, we're supporting you in this and we're trying to get it done. Now they're looking really closely at priority 3 and 4 calls, which sometimes don't get addressed at all today, but where reports should be taken and some response needs to be made. Lisa Herbold pointed out that in 2021, there were 230 days in which the SPD didn't respond at all to priority 3 and 4 calls. They just went into a queue.
I was going to say for sometimes I would substitute the words almost never.
Yeah. So, 230 out of 365 is most of the time, right? So Herbold pointed out it's important to move on figuring out if civilians can handle these calls, because there should be some response. They shouldn't just be, go into a queue and then eventually be deleted. Now, Andrew Lewis suggested that the mayor look at the retail theft program that the city already does, and figure out if those civilians that are hired by stores to write up reports that are later then reviewed and signed by a Seattle Police Department detective couldn't be a model for other types of situation where civilians are sent out, reports need to be taken and evidence gathered, and then a detective reviews it and just signs it later. Now, he particularly wanted to report back on the civilian service officers and parking enforcement officers and if they could be civilian teams who could do these reports on lower priority calls. Now, the Seattle Police Department is still doing their risk managed demand analysis, according to Monisha Harrell. And she said that the mayor is hoping to get their report any day now, sometime in July. And the mayor's office is hoping to have it analyzed, be able to do a presentation to the council by August. Although Lisa Herbold later in the discussion, openly invited them to come back for the second public safety meeting in July. So she's pushing them to get it done sooner. Now, as part of this analysis that the SPD is doing, there may be some calls that require immediate response, but not an SPD officer with a gun and badge to respond. So that intermediate category, and Monisha Harrell said this is why they're going a little more slowly than the council wants, is because there's this intermediate category between those two types of calls we were just talking about, the priority 1 and 2 and the priority 3 and 4. There may be some priority 1 or 2 calls that are, say, mental health crisis, persons undergoing a mental health crisis may need immediate response, but definitely does not need, and we've seen this in the past, doesn't need a couple of guys zooming up in a car, pulling a gun on them, right, and eventually shooting them when they're just having a mental health crisis, right? And they're so So that category, she called it a third department. So the idea is that the mayor's office is considering, okay, you know, we can maybe put these over into a third type of call that we can have special teams set up for to respond to. Okay. So Andrew Lewis pointed out that other cities have done this whole process a whole lot more quickly. He's happy that the mayor's
I'm trying not to laugh.
I know that the mayor's office is evaluating all these types of calls, but this delay means that we're missing out on addressing the low-hanging fruit for, you know, and we could be missing out for 2 years or 3 years when we could be moving some calls over right now. And Lisa Herbold seconded that. Andrew Meyerberg then responded. Up to this point, Monisha Harrell had been doing most of the talking, and then Andrew Meyerberg kind of jumped in here, and he said that the mayor's office has done a lot of research into what other jurisdictions have done, and that research is ongoing. And then Monisha Harrell, in other words, saying, we're working on that.
I'm expecting a blue ribbon commission comprised of chiefs, police chiefs from other jurisdictions anytime now.
Right. And Monisha Harrell responded that Health One is already answering some calls. But then Lisa Herbold and Andrew Lewis pointed out that Health One is really support for the fire department, not the Seattle Police Department. Harrell also said that the mayor's office wants to be very deliberate and, quote, set them up for long-term success, end quote. These civilian teams she was referring to. Then she complained that there weren't enough CSO staff available to cover the whole city. So that's kind of a chicken and egg argument, sort of that, well, we could move some calls over, but we don't have enough people yet. And that's the same issue that the Seattle Police Department is undergoing. And then Lisa Herbold.
And we don't have enough people yet because we haven't assigned the
duties over yet, and
or budgeted for it. Yeah.
Well, actually, the city council has budgeted, and Lisa Herbold pointed out that the city council has budgeted for 24 community service officers, and the city only has 13 hired. So she's concerned and been concerned for a while now, and said it openly in city council meetings. You know, I'm hoping that these incentives that we're using to hire more police officers are also going to hire more community service officers. Okay. And then Herbold also pointed out that this time last year, the mayor's office, this is the previous mayor's office she's talking about, said they were ready to create a triage one team to do wellness checks and respond to person down calls. These, which if you think about it, these are those third category calls that Monisha Harrell was talking about, right? And Herbold went on to say that there was no discussion then about needing to do any analysis, and that whole process of moving those calls over got hung up because of labor union discussions. Herbold pointed out that the city council funded those 24 CSOs. That's when she pointed out that they funded 24 community service officer positions, and that they are ready to fund more. Let's have that conversation, right? And Monisha Harrell's response boiled down to, no, let's slow down and be deliberate, right? And then Harrell said the prior mayor, she didn't know what the prior mayor's office was doing.
What was her name again?
That's Monisha Harrell. Yeah.
No, the prior mayor.
That prior mayor, Jenny Durkin. She didn't know what Durkin's office was doing, and Monisha Harrell just basically said the system's not ready yet to do all of this, but they're working on it and they're making good progress, you know. Andrew Lewis kind of, you know, and then they listened for a little while when Monisha Harrell talked about stuff that's already going on, right?
Okay, but bonus points to the first council member who has their head in their hands at this point.
Yeah, well, Andrew Lewis. Andrew Lewis suggested, he came back and he suggested a pilot program with one team, one van, with two EMTs in it, one data support person and one supervisor. And the data support person could be collecting data on, you know, outcomes and how well the team is working, right? And he said this program, he's talked with the central staffers, the council central staffers, and this program would cost between $700,000 to $1 million. And he said that the cities that he's looked at that have done these pilot programs have been able to scale them up successfully. And he wants to work on this further. And Monisha Harrell kind of perked up at that point, and she said, oh, yeah, let's do that. Yeah, that's great. And then she said that the mayor's office is looking at what units already exist, the CSOs, for example, and what types of calls they could take, including what kinds of calls do they want to take, and what kinds of calls could be trained to take.
Not to take anything away from Andrew Lewis, but it doesn't require, you know, Einstein level imagination to come up with that idea. So what is Harrell's office doing?
Well, that was the question. And Monisha Harrell kind of sat up and perked up like, wow, I hadn't thought of that.
Exactly.
Doing a pilot program, which really kind of puts the lie to what Andrew Meyerberg said. They're clearly not looking at what other cities have done, because if they had, they would have seen that the cities that have implemented this successfully have all had these pilot programs in place. It was Andrew Lewis who had to bring that up, right? So much of the presentation was just, you know, we're working on it. Is essentially what the mayor's office team was saying. And even Alex Peterson at some point chimed in that it would be great if we can move on some of this, right? We also need to figure out the cost to stand up these services, including city-based behavioral health that's not reliant on King County behavioral health. You know, so again, Alex Peterson was focusing on this third category of calls. Andrew Meyerberg again jumped in there, and he responded with, we need to staff up. That's essentially what Monisha Harrell said, so that these civilian teams can respond to 911 call response times at the same level that SPD officers do with the same response times. And I'm thinking, what? I'm not sure why. You know, why do they have to respond with the same speed as SPD officers? But, you know, again, the chicken and the egg argument, you know, we need to staff up, but we're not ready to staff up yet, right? And Monisha Harrell said that the mayor's office will roll out a pilot if they think they can do it, but they have some limited resources financially and personnel-wise. So again, they were kind of all grouping together with the, oh, we don't have the resources yet, right?
Now, bear in mind that this whole initiative came out of the 2020 defund the police movement and protests.
Mm-hmm,
so
yeah.
It smacks of leadership, both of SPD and of the mayor's office, not really being whole into this idea of reforming SPD. You know, it's like, yeah, I guess we kind of have to do that. I guess it's kind of a good idea. Maybe we should do that. Let's think about it some more.
Yeah. Monisha Harrell and Meyerberg at that point, they said that they hadn't made any progress on triage one. This is the big thing takeaway from the meeting is that they kind of sat there and said, well, we don't know what triage one is. It wasn't well defined, so we haven't been working on it. Period.
Okay.
And yeah, I know. Lisa Herbel jumped in at that point and she said, hey, person down and wellness calls could be moved to a triage one team. That was the vision that last year, a year ago, that the mayor's office and the SPD together had identified about 8,000 calls that could be moved immediately to a triage one team. And Lewis agreed. And he said he wanted to start up a pilot program right now, you know.
And if you had any question about the definition, you know, we are connected by phone. You know, the second floor is connected to the upper level.
I'm sorry, Jav, you're kind of cutting out there.
The second floor is connected to the upper levels of City Hall by telephone service.
Yeah. So then at the very end of that presentation, Sarah Nelson had reserved her comments for the end.
this is going to be good.
Yeah, when she weighed in on the side of the Harrell administration, right? Yes, let's study it to death. That was essentially her comments. She made the, I think, erroneous comment that civilian responders will be nonprofits. That's not clear to me that they're going to be outside third parties, you know. And then she pointed out that nonprofit groups can't do the work 24/7, which actually is not true either, because the Downtown Emergency Services Center actually has a team called the Emergency Service Responders who do take calls directly from 911 to respond to people who are intoxicated or having an issue with drug use. And they are available 24/7. So nonprofits can do it 24/7. So Sarah Nelson's wrong about that. But then her classic comment at the very end, she ended her statements with, and this is a direct quote, "It's very complicated, and I just think we should proceed with alacrity and careful deliberation." You know, and it's like, okay, well, which is it, alacrity or careful deliberation?
Where did she learn that big word, alacrity?
I mean, I know.
That's four syllables, gosh.
Yeah, I'm like, you know, which is it, alacrity or careful deliberation?
I wonder if she knows what alacrity actually means.
I don't think she does, yeah. Andrew Lewis ended then with an example of a call in his own district where police showed up to respond to a person in mental health crisis and spent 2 hours with this person but weren't able to do anything because there was no crime being committed, okay? And they couldn't help that person. And this is exactly the type of call that needs someone other than a police officer. And it's happening every day. And it's time to at least start a pilot program. And Monisha Harrell agreed that this is important and that the city is trying to stand up and help get new places open that can provide services for mental health and be places where people in crisis can be taken by an SPD officer. So that shows you. I mean, it just is classic, and it shows you what the mayor's on.
I'm going to whimper now.
From anyway,
I'm going to whimper now. Yeah,
I know. So that's kind of the state of things with that, and we'll see. I'm kind of hoping that the city council can push hard enough to get the mayor's office and the SPD and to start the pilot program. And once the pilot program is running, there's good data there showing that it does and is making a difference, and then that will kind of start to shift the culture there at both the mayor's office and the SPD. We'll see.
Well, thank you.
I knew it would be an important presentation, which is why I took some time discussing it. That's kind of where we stand.
All right. Let's move on then to this week's COVID developments.
Yeah, I'm going to go past the pandemic pretty quickly because we got a lot of national news to get to. But we still have a pandemic going on. The CDC announcing this week that BA4, BA5, those two subvariants, are now dominant in all regions of the U.S. That includes the Pacific Northwest, which was the last holdout for that. Cases are declining slightly again in King County. But, we've still got a lot of summer events going on. We've still got a lot of people wanting to get indoors to, get out of the heat as we get hot days in the summer. And, wear a mask when you're indoors, especially in poorly vented areas, because there's still COVID. I was talking to someone just the other day who came down with COVID, and it's still around. So, be careful.
Oh, yeah. I'm at home isolating this weekend because I was exposed to someone with COVID last week. So I'm still kind of in the range of days when I can't quite test yet to see if I've gotten it. It's going to be another day or so, but that's not something I had planned for, being isolated at home over the July 4th weekend, because COVID's still circulating.
Well, you're being a lot more responsible than many people.
Probably, and that's probably why it's still circulating.
Yep, exactly.
It's not funny, but yeah.
No, and almost nothing in the rest of the program is, but we'll probably still laugh.
Inevitably. All right, let's move on to this week's SCOTUS decisions and even a tangent to Washington State.
Yeah, the Supreme Court of Gilead ruled this week in favor of the former assistant football coach at Bremerton High School, who sued the school district after they suspended him for refusing to stop conducting public prayers at the 50-yard line after football games. Now, he was not fired, as was reported in a lot of local and national media. He simply refused to reapply for the job the following year. So the Supreme Court overturned a lower court ruling that found that Joseph Kennedy's lawsuit against the school district was materially false in its description of, short private, short private personal prayer. It wasn't short and it certainly wasn't private. It was at the 50-yard line. And, there were students present, which is runs contrary to what Kennedy presented in court also. It wasn't personal. And
there was peer pressure on the students to join him.
Yes, exactly. So, the material facts by which the Supreme Court found in favor of Kennedy, were basically false. You can go back to 2015, which is when the lawsuit originated and all this happened, and look at news articles from then, and it will describe exactly what those prayers were. And they were not what the Supreme Court in its majority opinion found. They ruled 6-3, along ideological lines that, the Bremerton School District erred in not letting Kennedy have his private personal prayers. Unlike many of the other rulings this week, which we'll get to in a minute, this one is basically continuing the current Supreme Court's fixation with allowing religion in public life. And particularly
the Christian religion.
Yes, specifically the Christian religion. Specifically the evangelical Christian religion.
Yeah, one of the things that really...
And particularly on the taxpayer dime.
Right, and one of the things that really struck me about the case was that it kind of blew up in the face of the Bremerton school district when other groups decided that they wanted to also have their ceremonies on the 50-yard line, including a group of Satanists.
Yes.
Saying that, well, if
those wacky Satanists.
Yeah, if you've got a coach that's leading Christian prayer, well, why can't we have a ceremony on the 50-yard line too?
Yeah.
the Bremerton school district.
That sounds like fun.
Yeah, the Bremerton school district said, okay, look, a football game is not an appropriate place for this. Which is totally reasonable, right?
Yeah, it really is.
But not if you're the Supreme Court, not if you're a conservative evangelical Christian who sits on the Supreme Court of the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, so that was a disappointing ruling. But let's move on to some of the other rulings.
Okay.
So there was. Start, or shall I?
Yeah, there was one win this week in the case Biden versus Texas. So voting 5-4 with two of the conservative justices, Chief Justice John Roberts and Brett Kavanaugh, joining the three more liberal justices, Stephen Breyer, Sonia Sotomayor, and Elena Kagan, the court overturned a decision by two lower courts to prevent President Biden from repealing Donald Trump's Remain in Mexico immigration policy, which required most asylum seekers from Central and South America to be sent back to Mexico while waiting for their asylum cases to be heard in U.S. courts. Now, the majority of the justices found that the lower courts, in this case, a Texas judge and the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, had incorrectly interpreted U.S. immigration laws, saying that the president must turn back immigrants to another country. The law actually says may turn back immigrants which indicates that presidents have discretion in how they choose to enforce U.S. immigration law, something that had been non-controversial until these two lower courts made the ruling that, oh, no, we know better, and we are the enforcement arm of the U.S. government, not the president.
Yeah. And the Texas judge and also the Fifth Circuit panel were all Trump appointees.
Yes, so they were all conservative appointees. So, yeah, so that was one win this week in what's been a pretty dismal court session. Did you want to talk about the EPA one, or should I?
Yeah. I think one of the things that came out of the Roe decision a week ago that didn't get as much attention was the fact that Roe had been settled constitutional law for 50 years, right? Mm-hmm. And it's very rare for the Supreme Court to overturn past precedent that's been on the books for that long, and that subsequent decisions have been cited as precedent. For instance, the Casey decision. You know, one of the best known examples is Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka in 1954, which overturned again about a half century's worth of precedent in terms of separate but equal in public schooling. However, when that has happened in the history of the Supreme Court, it has always been in the direction of expanding individual rights until now. Because of course, with the overturning of Roe last week, that, took away individual rights, specifically the right of women to have an abortion or have appropriate reproductive health care. The decision this week regarding the EPA took that a step further. Instead of taking away settled law for 50 years, it took away settled law for over 100 years. And that was the right, basically, of any regulatory body in the executive branch to regulate. The majority of the court ruled, again, 6-3, ideological lines, that only Congress can delegate the right to regulate. In other words, if Congress hasn't specifically given this agency the right in actual past law to regulate a specific topic, then the agency cannot regulate it. That pretty much destroys most of the regulatory agencies in the United States. In this case, the court ruled in favor of the state of West Virginia and against the EPA over its ability to regulate greenhouse gases for the damage they do to to climate change. Now,
they were specifically looking at the EPA's ability to regulate under the Clean Air Act.
Yes.
And it's important to remember that the Clean Air Act was passed, I believe, back in the 70s.
Yeah, 1972.
Long before greenhouse gas emissions were identified as a pollution source and climate change was identified as a risk to the human race as well as many other species on the planet.
Yeah, so what this means is that if a crisis comes up that Congress for some reason didn't anticipate when it passes the law, then the agency cannot respond to that crisis. It really hamstrings the executive branch in its ability to regulate or be flexible enough to respond to modern problems. This is something that the Federalist Society has wanted with its emphasis on originalism. Climate change didn't exist when the framers wrote the Constitution, so we can't respond to it. Needless to say, this is a conservative wet dream.
Yeah, and I want to point out, too, that this week Joe Biden finally said it's time to repeal the filibuster in the Senate and move on some of these priorities in Congress. And I just thought it was kind of interesting that the overturning of Roe didn't spark that. It was the overturning of the EPA's ability to regulate greenhouse gas emissions that sparked that. So.
Yeah, and, you know, it comes about a year and 6 months too late.
Yes, but, it does.
You know, for example, Congress was not able, because the Senate was not able to pass the Fair Voting Act, which was, you know, been languishing in D.C. And as a result, we're going to have midterms that are, you know, potentially grossly unfair. And
that was the other big loss this week.
We'll get to that next. So it's not looking good for democracy at this point. But
no, and so that big voting rights loss was in Louisiana, where the conservative justices voted 6-3 to issue. Well, they didn't actually take an actual vote. It was an emergency order, and the Supreme Court doesn't have to disclose whether or not they voted on it. They just and they don't have to write a full-on decision, but they issued an emergency order on Tuesday allowing the state of Louisiana to use Republican-drawn congressional districts, even though those districts obviously violate the Voting Rights Act. A lower court had ruled that the map in Louisiana be altered to add a second majority black district because Louisiana has 6 districts total and about 1/3 of its population is black. The Republican-drawn districts had only drawn up 1 black majority district. Now, the Louisiana state legislature had refused the lower court's order to redraw the map before this November's election, and they appealed for an emergency order by the Supreme Court, and the conservatives on the Supreme Court were very happy to issue that order in the Louisiana state legislature's favor. Now, the court noted that it will be taking up a similar case in October regarding gerrymandered districts in Alabama, which also has only 1 majority black district out of 7 total. Until the court decides in that case, Louisiana can now continue to use its gerrymandered districts for these midterm elections coming up this year.
And I'm expecting the Alabama decision will restore 3/5, since that's what the framers originally wanted to count blacks as. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's not just restricting voting to property of white men.
Yeah.
So that's
the dismal news with this, I think, historically bad Supreme Court session.
Yeah. And this past week has been particularly bad. And the media coverage of it has been bad, too. I want to say that, you know, the whole issue around respecting precedents, which has been the norm in Supreme Court decisions, at least for the last century, really got almost no media attention from the Roe decision on through this week's decisions. This is a very radical Supreme Court, both in terms of putting religion into specifically Christian religion into the public sphere again, in terms of corporate rights, and in terms of repealing individual rights that have been hard fought for the last 100 years. And people should be very, very concerned, because a lot of these decisions are all but inviting additional cases to be filed to repeal additional rights. And we're going to see those cases come up in the next year or two as they wind their way through the courts. It's a very, very dangerous time, and you know, the conservative majority that Donald Trump left us with is going to have ramifications for at least a generation.
Also this week, speaking of the Supreme Court, Ketanji Brown Jackson was sworn in, so that was one.
Yes, indeed. That was a historic first. Justice Stephen Breyer officially retired, and his replacement, Ketanji Brown Jackson, the first first black woman on the U.S. Supreme Court, was sworn in. So that was a historic first, and the one, I think, really positive piece of news this week.
Yeah, and that was on Friday, because the actual term ended on June 30th, which is why you got
Thursday.
Yes, which is why you got these flurry of decisions this week.
Mm-hmm. All right.
After which they all flee town. As they should.
On to developments with this week's January 6th hearings.
Yeah, there were not originally January 6th hearings scheduled for this week, and then an emergency one was called on Tuesday with a mystery witness that was not announced in advance. That witness turned out to be a 25-year-old woman named Cassidy Hutchinson. She was an aide to the chief of staff for Mark Meadows, who in turn was the chief of staff for President Trump. So she was in the room for a lot of the January 6th events. And what she described, honestly, it was pretty earth-shaking. And I thought the media coverage of her testimony trivialized it in a lot of cases. I mean, the color was certainly colorful. That the idea that Donald Trump tried to grab a steering wheel from the Secret Service agent who was driving his limo so as to drive it toward the Capitol rather than back to the White House after his speech at the Ellipse on January 6th, or that he was so angry that he had been unable to get to the Capitol that he threw his lunch plate against the wall as he was watching the riot unfold on TV. Those things weren't nearly as important as some of the other takeaways. And I want to highlight one quote in particular that Cassidy Hutchinson in particular quoted from she heard Trump say, and I'm going to have to dance around a couple of these words because the FCC doesn't like them and there may be children listening. But this is Donald Trump railing at his security detail to take away the magnetometer that were routinely used to screen people for weapons as they're coming in to see the president. And of course, it was a heavily armed group, as we now know. Quote, "I don't effing care that they have weapons. They're not here to hurt me. They're not here to hurt me. Take the effing magnometers away. Let my people in. They can march to the Capitol from here. Let the people in and take the mags away." So this is Donald Trump saying, if they're not going to hurt me, I don't care if they hurt anybody else.
Right.
I mean, it is the pithiest example of his narcissism I have ever heard. His sociopathy too. The fact that he doesn't care if other people get hurt. And as we know, five law enforcement officers lost their lives as a result of the January 6th riot.
And as a matter of fact, he was urging that at least one person be hurt, and that was his own vice president.
Yeah.
He was urging, he was hoping that the mob would go and actually string him up and hang Mike Pence. So, yeah, that was another revelation.
And probably the most important part of Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony is that we finally have somebody testifying under oath in Trump's own words that the intent was there to incite violence, that he wanted the violence, that he was trying to orchestrate the violence. And this opens him up to criminal prosecution in a way that was much murkier before her testimony. Mm-hmm. Now, there are still two more hearings for the January 6th committee. And those promise to directly tie Trump and the various thuggish groups that were coordinating the violence, things like the Oath Keepers and the Three Percenters and the Proud Boys. Remember that the leaders of the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys have already been indicted for seditious conspiracy. So was Trump part of that conspiracy? It's certainly looking that way.
Yeah, and in addition, he also considered, as we learn now from Cassidy Hutchinson, Trump also considered pardoning all of the rioters. So not only was he urging violence, knew that they were armed, even urging violence against specific individuals like Mike Pence, he was also talking about, okay, once they do it, I'm going to abuse my power and I'm going to pardon them all.
And something else happened after Hutchinson's testimony this week. We found out that a Trump-aligned PAC has been has been basically paying the legal fees for a lot of the people accused around January 6th. And that Hutchison, after her testimony, faced a lot of harassment from Trump-aligned groups also. This smacks of mob style, politics. This is how mobs operate.
Yeah, a witness tampering, essentially, yeah, by taking all the people who could potentially testify against you and saying, I'm providing your lawyer, I'm paying your legal fees, you say what I want you to say.
Yeah, and the reason for Hutchison's surprise emergency hearing was that she fired the lawyer that had been generously provided to her by the Trump groups and hired different counsel just before her testimony.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so there were a couple other things I want to add on to that, too, that were revelations I thought were really important.
There were a lot of them.
She confirmed that Mark Meadows and Rudy Giuliani both were seeking pardons from Donald Trump because they knew that this would all blow back on them. Okay.
Yes.
And then she also confirmed that there was very serious talks within the White House about invoking the 25th Amendment to remove Trump from power because of many of these issues. So those were two other things that she really confirmed that I thought were very important. So her testimony was a major bombshell. And as Job said earlier, it's linking Trump very securely within this group of people who should be criminally charged.
And, you know, there's two more hearings to go. So, and they're probably, my guess is, since there are a lot of former federal prosecutors on the January 6th committee, and they've given every indication that they know exactly what they're doing, they're handling this very well. Mm-hmm. They're probably saving the best for last. So
yeah, there are indications that there's even more revelations coming down the line that are, you know, even more shocking than what we've seen so far from Cassidy Hutchison.
And all of this makes clear to anybody who still lives in, you know, rational universe, which is about 2/3 of the U.S. population and may or may not be a majority of the people whose votes are actually allowed and counted in 2024, that Donald Trump should be allowed nowhere near public office. He should not be allowed to be a dog catcher, honestly, in West Palm County or whatever the county is down there.
All right.
He's a danger.
So can we talk for a minute about a story that I had last week that we didn't get to? I think we've got a couple minutes.
We have 2 minutes.
Okay. So I just want to mention that ProPublica, which is a great resource on the internet for independent investigative journalism, they had an article. They are wonderful, and highly recommended. They had an article recently on how the ultra wealthy avoid taxes. It's entitled 10 Ways.
Oh, yeah.
Ten Ways Billionaires Avoid Taxes on an Epic Scale, and the author is Paul Keel. And it's actually a summary of a much longer, more detailed series of stories that ProPublica ran about a year ago, and it's an update on that.
Can you spell Keel?
Keel, K-I-E-L. Paul, K-I-E-L.
Okay.
It's a nice hard-hitting summary of some of the ways that the rich abuse tax law and avoid paying their fair share. So it covers things like, some of the schemes include things like paying themselves in stock instead of cash and then borrowing money to spend using the increasing value of their stock as collateral. Okay. Something that you and I can't do. Placing low-value stock into a personal Roth IRA and then letting it grow immensely in value with no taxes needing to be paid on the capital gains in a personal Roth IRA, and then taking tax-free distributions later when your shares are sold. Okay. Buying a sports team and using depreciation rules to show a loss even when the team is making money. So just one scheme after another.
And guess who wrote those tax laws? Yeah.
Oh, yes, yes. So I that's highly recommended. And if you want some good weekend reading, I recommend that ProPublica article, 10 Ways Billionaires Avoid Taxes on an Epic Scale by Paul Keel, K-I-E-L.
All right. Well, that's, I'm sure that's our uplifting note for the week.
So. Yeah. Go enjoy your holiday weekend, and we'll be back with more good news next week.
Yes.
Guaranteed.